Screen or this is enough, you think?
Okay.
Okay.
So that's good.
This pointer is working?
I don't need it.
That's fine.
Yeah, that's okay. No, only if it's needed. Okay. I'm just going to like go ahead and start. As usual, the attention span is never more than 15-20 minutes, so I try to finish in 40 minutes. So you're really free to interrupt and ask me questions. And I'm going to really do it more clinical oriented, where when you really take care of the patient, what happens. I'm not going to go into pathophysiology that much, because there's a lot of theories behind it. And we still do not know the cause like many other diseases in medicine. All we need is at least clinically how to take care of them. So coming to this condition, in the past when we said ARDS, it meant adult respiratory distress syndrome. Now they changed the acronym to acute respiratory distress syndrome, because they wanted it to differentiate when it was first described from the pediatric respiratory distress syndrome, which was clear-cut surfactant deficiency and occurred more in premature infants and everything. But this was like, you know, a type of the same respiratory distress syndrome occurring in adults. They didn't know the cause. That's why it was called as adult respiratory distress syndrome. Even now, actually, in one of the theories, there is some surfactant deficiency even in adults, quote unquote, they say, but we haven't been able to prove. So that's why they changed it. Because now this kind of acute respiratory distress syndrome also occurs in pediatric population. So that's why they changed the acronym from ARDS, from adult respiratory distress syndrome, to acute respiratory distress syndrome. So actually the first case report was published really in Lancet, and 12 patients actually they described. The classic clinical features were acute respiratory distress, cyanosis, diffuse pulmonary infiltrates, decreased lung compliance, and it was very refractory to oxygen therapy. And basically the same definition holds good this day and age really. And also they used to call it as a shock lung, because people who were like in trauma, when army people like were in the war and everything, they were in trauma, next day they had hypoxemia, infiltrates and all. So the patient was in shock and they developed this kind of symptom, they used to call it shock lung. And the x-ray used to look as if it was in pulmonary edema, so they also called it wet lung, but obviously it was a non-cardiac cause. So it went by many acronyms and everything like that before. Coming to the estimate really, crude estimates are 78.9 per 100,000 population. In the United States, roughly 150,000 cases happen annually, and it's almost equivalent to pulmonary embolism and all. But these cases, remember, mortality is very high. And the inpatient mortality now, according to the Washington University in St. Louis, which kept data actually from the 1960s, the inpatient mortality progressively decreased from about 60%, now about 30-40%. And that also is not because we know the cause, it's because we got good at better supportive care, better managing the patients with arrhythmias, looking for renal failure, we are getting dialysis support, CVVH, and following the electrolytes, preventing arrhythmias, and treating sepsis early with antibodies. That's exactly what made the difference, not because we know the cause. And the cost really is this, 3.6 million hospital days. That's what makes this disease very expensive. And it's a very characteristic disease of the ICU. And coming to, like, you know, 1999, American Thoracic Society came up with a statement on acute respiratory distress syndrome. You can go to www.thoracic.org and get this statement from American Thoracic Society. These days I'm really trying to save paper and not printing. So you guys, you know, everybody's computer savvy now, can go ahead and print it. And most of the recommendations and guidelines are really based on that consensus statement, because the definition is still not very clear cut. And now they actually, acute respiratory distress, there's also like added on called acute lung injury. They're basically the same thing, acute lung injury and the ARDS. Only the definition comes to partial pressure of oxygen divided by fraction of inspired oxygen. It is less than 300 in acute lung injury and less than 200 in ARDS. That means ARDS is a severe form of acute lung injury. It starts off as an acute lung injury and that progresses to ARDS. So both are the same spectrum really. Hypoxemic respiratory failure, a severe version of which is ARDS. And in the past, you know, around the same time ARDS was defined, the SWAN came into existence in 1969, I guess. That time the two classic conditions that presented with bilateral diffuse pulmonary infiltrates and white lung is our acute CHF or acute lung injury. So that's why actually this definition of pulmonary capillary wedge pressure or the left atrial pressure being less than 18 millimeters became the classic defining criteria. Everybody used to have a SWAN whenever they used to come with bilateral infiltrates, intubated, hypoxic. And when the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, these days we call it pulmonary artery occlusive pressure, that's the right term really. Less than 18 really defines ARDS. More than 18, technically it is CHF. And the PaO to FI to ratio. And remember in your boards when they give, to put fraction of inspired oxygen concentration. So when it's 40%, it's 0.4. When it is 60%, it's really 0.6. So remember to use that number with your partial pressure. And this is irrespective of PEEP. Sometimes you can define it on a PEEP of 5, and when you increase the PEEP, the oxygenation improves. So it's irrespective of PEEP, this definition. So don't over-explain by taking PEEP into consideration. And the additional features really, patients have bilateral widespread infiltrates on chest X-ray. And although it is said as diffuse, it's rarely very diffuse. And it's not all the time homogeneous infiltrates. You can get actually scattered infiltrates. And there is always airway collapse with lung volumes. And this is why actually alveolar recruitment becomes a very key strategy in ventilatory management of these patients with ARDS. All of them have low lung volumes and airway collapse. And as I said, it's not clearly proven, but there is surfactant deficiency, and they also have a surfactant protein B gene also associated with it, and they think there is also a genetic component. And I've seen quite a lot of ARDS cases in ICU, but I haven't seen recurrent ARDS. You know, people do come with pneumonia and everything, but maybe with the same patient never gets admitted or something, I cannot tell. So the genetic component, we really don't know the data much. But apparently they're trying to identify some genes related to it. And obviously they have reduced lung compliance because of the alveolar infiltrates and the stiff lung. And more than 60 causes are there actually that can cause ARDS if you really define each one of them. But the real common causes are really direct insult to the lungs, bacterial, viral, fungal, lung contusion, fat embolism. And there are other systemic causes like trauma, shock, sepsis, burns, pancreatitis, and noxious agents like exposure to smoke. And obviously, this is the commonest thing I keep seeing, aspiration pneumonia leading to ARDS. So that's why preventing that. I've known a patient when somebody was trying to put an NG tube, he vomited so bad, all the lactulose ended up in the lungs. Within 12 hours, next day he was dead from rapidly progressive ARDS. So that's exactly, aspiration also can cause it. And the other thing to mention is, in patients who have actually ARDS from a primary lung infection, apparently do worse than people with systemic conditions leading to ARDS. And there's only data now coming out. If pneumonia is a starting process, they actually have worse prognosis than resulting from trauma, like a urosepsis, not pneumonia leading to sepsis, burns, pancreatitis and everything. And these are the common list that I just put it. And something to remember is massive lung blood transfusion. I think this comes in your boards also. They call transfusion related acute lung injury. This is really seen in patients who receive more than 15 units of PRPC transfusion in a 24 to 48 hour period. It is not just volume overload. Okay, volume overload is something that probably you can treat with Lasix and preload reduction and some afterload reducing agent. This is not just related to volume overload. This is actually an acute lung injury and inflammatory process. It is seen in people. I've seen like 2 or 3 cases who came with massive cirrhosis bleed. I've seen even with 8 or 9 units, not really 15 units. But the classic description is you should anticipate when you give more than few units. But classic description is more than 15 units of blood transfusion. And this is the classic X-ray. Most of them, you know, CHF can have some pleural effusions and everything like that. They have diffuse bilateral infiltrates and everything. Nowadays, although like, you know, SWAN is not mandatory, any case of sepsis, early CVP monitoring is recommended. Because in all sepsis trials that can lead to ARDS, they want to like assess CVP. They want mixed venous O2 sat from the CVP and also a lactate level to prognosticate and also monitor the patients. So that's why at least a CVP is indicated when patients are in severe ARDS. This is the concept. Actually, like nowadays, portable chest X-ray, the sensitivity is probably 70%, 70 to 85%. You can miss things on a portable chest X-ray. So we are even like a good PA and lateral now, the sensitivity is probably 90% because now we have CAT scans to look at it. So once CAT scan came into existence, we really realized it is really not uniform in distribution. The infiltrates are like really, you know, non-homogeneous, can be like scattered, more on one side. You know, classically they do not have much of any pleural effusions like in CHF. Okay, and coming to the pathophysiology, basically there is an altered capillary permeability secondary to endothelial injury. But the basic definition also, they say there has to be an endothelial injury. In addition, there also should be an epithelial injury. And it's the degree of epithelial injury in animal studies and all that really predicts the outcome. And in animal studies, the way they create ARDS, classically the model for rats is they inject fecal matter into the rats, and that causes really severe gram-negative sepsis, and that gives the typical ARDS model for studies. And that's why it's really like very common with gram-negative infections, classically the Pseudomonas, E. coli, simple urosepsis. I've known people who come up with this acute lung injury, ARDS-like picture. So many times we begin thinking maybe there is aspiration pneumonia, maybe there is bacterial pneumonia on top of it. It's really not true. It's the acute lung injury coming to secondary to the severe gram-negative sepsis. And the other thing is why patients have hypoxemia is not only because the alveolar diffusing capacity is altered, but there is increased intrapulmonary shunt. So there's a lot of intrapulmonary shunting, so there's a lot of VQ mismatch. That's why 95% of the cause of hypoxemia is VQ mismatch. And that's what is classically happens in that. Only in 5%, you know, you have like high altitude, other things to account for the rest of the causes of hypoxemia. 95% of the time it's intrapulmonary shunt. And also, like, you know, the classically the type of alveolar cells that are really involved are the type 2 alveolar cells. And they actually disrupt the fluid transport and they impair the removal of fluid from alveolar space. And that's why people who are in ARDS, actually now there are like 2 groups of people. One, people really like say you have to keep the patient as dry as possible to facilitate oxygen. You support the patient if they are a little hypovolemic or something, even using some pressors rather than giving 5 liters of fluid and flooding the patient with a lot of you know, fluids and keeping, making the bed wet lung. And you know, there are, if you are interested, there are now studies showing the difference in the fluid management. The alveolar volume is only a difference of 19 to 30 ml, but that makes a lot of difference in oxygenation of the patient too. So that's why it's very important to, like, you know, to try to keep the patient as dry as possible rather than flooding with this thing. And also the type 2 pneumocytes also are injured. That's what actually leads to decreased surfactant production, and that leads to worsening atelectasis and gas exchange. And histopathologically, this is really divided into 3 phases. The exudative phase, which is seen in days 1 to 3, and there is diffuse alveolar damage leading to type 1 pneumocyte necrosis and leaking of the proteinaceous material into the interstitium. And you know, in the past, if people, SWAN will probably be outdated in the future And by 2011, critical care now, ultrasound is mandatory for critical care training physicians. So Swan will get a... In the past, there are people who try to like take from the pulmonary distal catheter, they used to like take some blood and check for this proteinaceous material. If you found some of it, it's most likely the patient has ARDS. And some people, when they do lavage, they also found some proteinaceous material or pneumocytes like that. But we don't use that anymore. For people who are interested, going back to the keeping the wet lung and dry lung, now actually there are certain features in critical care ultrasound that are coming up. So there are some lines that you can define, like Kelly B lines and all these lines. They can see some lines if it is ARDS rather than CHF. So that's how actually you also can change your management. So although we have new technology, remember it's all again user dependent. Swan also, the interpretation was so poor even among critical care physicians. They never like, you know, were able to manage the Swan readings properly. It all is like physician dependent. So ultrasound also, it's very useful for tamponade, for pleural effusion, but actually like defining ARDS probably will again be user dependent on the clinical quality of the physicians. And date fibroproliferative phase is really day 3 to 7, type 1 pneumocyte hyperplasia and then fibroblast. And after this phase, when there is actually fibroblast proliferation, that's when actually there are people who like recommend steroids may improve the outcome. Again, steroids is very, very controversial in people who actually have ARDS. And coming to the, as I said, I'm not going to like go into, this is how the normal intact alveolar, interstitium, basement membrane, the pneumocytes and all look. When there is damage, there is leakage of fluid, there is breakdown of the epithelium and the pyroepithelium, and then it's like the cytokine. And during the proliferation, sorry, I didn't silence it. Okay, hyaline membrane, viral edematous interstitium and destruction of the basement membrane. And you get the fibrin, cell membrane, oxidants, interleukins. All of these cytokines are what really worsen the damage. And when you actually like are ventilating, which we are going to like come, when you cause over-distension of alveoli, you actually can damage the alveolar epithelium and endothelium more. And you actually can cause release of the cytokines more in these cases. So that's why actually you have to be very careful in the ventilatory management. And during the resolution phase, repair happens by the proliferation of the type 2 pneumocytes and the resolution of the fibrosis. And that's another thing actually, people have followed patients who have recovered completely from ARDS. In theory, there is actually oxygen radical toxicity to the pulmonary alveolar epithelium and endothelium. So they say, at least in rats it's proven, if you give 100% oxygen for more than 6 hours, there is patient can develop pulmonary fibrosis. But in reality, people who recovered from ARDS, who have been on 100% for even 10 days, there is no side effects of oxygen toxicity that we notice. More than 90% of the people who recover from ARDS have normal pulmonary function tests. The rest 10%, the only thing they noticed was a slight decrease in forced vital capacity. So that's why although theoretically you want to decrease the FiO2 to as low as below 60% and as soon as possible, if you cannot oxygenate the patient and patient is dying on you, sometimes you have to maintain them on 100% oxygen, you have to maintain. And there are ways you try to recruit the alveoli by increasing the PEEP and decreasing the FiO2. But there are times when you give a PEEP of 24, 100% FiO2, still you are unable to oxygenate or ventilate the patient. That's when actually you really have to use 100% oxygen. And there are no long-term side effects in the recent data public. This data came up in 2000 in NEJM, this article actually, ARDS survivors, if you want to go back and see the thing. And again, treatment of ARDS, really the cornerstone as I'm mentioning is to keep the PO2 around 60 millimeters without causing injury to the lung with excessive O2 or even now excessive tidal volume. And also we like to keep the plateau pressure around 30 millimeters. We allow even up to like 35 really, not exactly 30 millimeters. And minimal tidal volume should be at least 4 ml and maximum not more than 8 ml. So ideally we give 6 ml per kg body weight. And remember, this is for ideal body weight. Please do not give it actual body weight. More and more we have. And there are ways actually based on the height to calculate the ideal body weight too. So don't give like, even if you get like 300 pound patient or something, don't give like 1500 ml or something. This is based on ideal body weight for you to know. And the same thing about the definition I'm telling. This is the term to remember. You try to oxygenate the patient with minimal FiO2. You also don't give volutrauma and barotrauma. Barotrauma you avoid by keeping the plateau pressure below 30, and volutrauma you avoid by giving not more than 8 ml per kg body weight, ideally 6 ml per kg body weight. Okay, so that's something. And coming back to the American Thoracic Society recommendation, these are the 5 things to remember. Try to minimize O2 toxicity. Try to recruit alveoli, because I said alveolar collapse is one of the key features in the pathophysiology of acute respiratory distress syndrome. And minimize high airway pressures, prevent atelectasis. And this is a new thing, using sedation and paralysis very judicially, because the longer you use sedation and paralysis, the longer the patient remains intubated. And the longer you keep the patient intubated, the more likely they are going to get ventilator-associated pneumonia. And that can cause secondary ARDS. You can get as a subsequent cause. So that's why actually you like to extubate this patient as soon as possible. And this is what has been like shown, that the sedation vacation, we are all hearing in the ICU now, right? So we try to wake up everybody. Although we are not following the guidelines by the recommendations, you have to give sedation vacation on everybody. The only 3 people like I would recommend not to give sedation vacation are people who are still on 100% and still requiring like 15-16 of PEEP. Those people, you won't be able to re-oxygenate them. Once you wake them up and decrease their work of breathing, that's one thing. And people who are requiring intubation for severe DTs, you try to wake them up and resedating them becomes very difficult. Or people who require very high dose pressors. These are the only 3 people you are not supposed to really give sedation vacation. But everybody else who are on 60% FiO2 to 50%, ideally you have to give sedation vacation. This clearly decreases the number of ventilator days. And I don't know if you have a slide. The thing that I always like, in the past, I always tell resident that an extra day of ET tube, 1% chance of ventilator pneumonia. Now there is data actually. At 30 days, the incidence of ventilator-associated pneumonia is 60%. You can now actually say that's 2% per day, just like UTI. You leave a Foley catheter, a day extra, 2% chance of UTI. You leave it for 2 days, 4%. So that's why the number of days you increase, the number of chance. The same thing now with ET tube. So early extubation by minimizing sedation is really recommended. And again, I told you, like, the only treatment we have is supportive care and treat the underlying cause. And most of the time, people who die of after like suffering from ARDS, it's not refractory hypoxemia that kills them. It's actually the secondary causes that kill them. A GI bleed, secondary ventilator associated pneumonia, secondary septic shock, massive MI, or undiagnosed pulmonary thromboembolism. That's why actually DVT prophylaxis and GI prophylaxis have become the key concept in ARDS patients who are mechanically ventilated. You have to make sure everybody gets adequate GI and DVT prophylaxis. Okay, and ventilatory strategies for the ARDS is really low tidal volume ventilation. And this again is in May 2000. This is the only thing actually, since for the past 40 years they have been like trying to see what changes the mortality in ARDS. Anything that made a difference is really low tidal volume ventilation, because high volumes overdistend the alveoli, release more cytokines and worsen your acute lung injury. So theoretically it worsens your hypoxemia. And NIH based study, and they actually showed a 22% reduction in mortality compared to patients ventilated with 10 to 12 ml per kg body weight. And that's another thing. And I think I'll mention this after this. The second concept is, first concept is low tidal volume ventilation. The second concept is open lung approach. This actually try to optimize the lung mechanics because they can have increased plateau pressure and everything like that. I have a slide, you'll understand when I show you the slide. You really have to like place the PEEP above the PEEP flask because you want to maintain the lung more compliant rather than shift. And the lung is supposed to be most compliant between the lower inflection point and the upper inflection point, because beyond that point, over distension occurs and then you'll also worsen the ARDS. So this is how actually the curve looks like. This is the P flex and this is the P max. And above this, patient will get alveolar over distension and then you can worsen the acute lung injury. This is the optimal range you can do. And if you really know what your P flux is, nowadays you have these sophisticated ventilators, you can get these graphs on the on your ventilators. If you know the graph and you can look at it, you can determine your P. Because you, if you know this P flex point, you give 2 centimeters more as a P. Suppose this P flex is 14, you give a PEEP of 16. If your P flex is 8, you give a PEEP of 10. If you, I know people who have used up to a PEEP of 24. I have never used that. But most of them with that degree of high PEEP end up with bilateral chest tubes or something. But there are people who advocated prophylactic chest tubes also in people with severe ARDS. Because that actually like dries them out and you can use as much volume as you can. You don't have to worry about sudden hemodynamic compromise from an undetected pneumothorax or barotrauma. So people have advocated, but that did not make any difference in the outcomes or mortality. So this is really the thing. Suppose if you do not have a graph like this, people say the ideal really PEEP is about 16 centimeters. Okay? So most of the time I end up going up to 14, 16 centimeters of PEEP and come down on the FIO2 is needed. Rarely I go more than 16 really. By the time either patient gets better or these days we'll really like try to like minimize this. This is the optimal range. Okay, and the other modes of ventilation in addition to the convention volume control ventilation, we use pressure control ventilation, we use the airway release pressure ventilation, all these new modalities, they do not make any difference really in the outcomes. But sometimes this one pressure control ventilation technically requires higher dose of sedation, and even sometimes you may need paralysis of the patient because you actually like patient pressure control can be very like uncomfortable for the patient, so patient will require more sedation. So but actually like sometimes when you are unable to ventilate or oxygenate the patients with the regular volume control, pressure control not only helps in oxygenating, it also prevents barotrauma, because here you are controlling the pressure, not the volume. Patient may get lower volumes. This is where the other concept, the phase that we use in ARDS called permissive hypercapnia. You can allow a pH up to 7.2 because most arrhythmias or other, decreased response to pressures and all do not occur unless the pH is below 7.2. So people allow permissive hypercapnia until a pH of 7.2. And sometimes there are people who get the PCO2 very high but maintain the pH by giving bicarbonate drip. They maintain a pH between 7.2 to 7.25. They don't mind how high the PCO2 goes. Because with pressure control, you're controlling the pressure, but the volume, because the lung is stiff, you're limiting the pressure. So the volume can be low, and that's how you cannot ventilate the patient as well. But most important is you maintain oxygenation. This actually prevents barotrauma. Whereas there is low volume, low tidal volume ventilation prevents volutrauma. Pressure control ventilation prevents barotrauma. That's where actually the key concept of ventilatory strategies is ARDS. And pressure usually we do not exceed 30, but usually I start at 35 actually, which is permissive. And going back actually, reverse IE ratio. When you are looking at the ventilatory strategies, normally when you have a respiratory cycle of 4 to 5 seconds, 3 or 4 seconds is exhalation phase. 1 or 2 seconds is really the inspiratory phase. But in these patients, you increase the inspiratory phase or equal the inspiratory and expiratory phase to 1:1 ratio or even 2:1 ratio. Because the longer the inspiratory phase is, the more time the alveolar has for gas exchange. That's how you maintain oxygen. So that's another concept you use in ventilatory strategy for ARDS management. Okay, and this is the new concept that our respiratory therapists are very fond of doing it. Studies have no difference, but the advantages are anybody with volume control ventilation, when they are unable to oxygenate or ventilate properly, you can switch to APRV or pressure control. With APRV, the advantage is you do not need as much sedation, and intermittently the patient is allowed to spontaneously breathe. So that's really the advantage. But this is what I would caution for practical purposes. I've seen residents like in the middle of the night, you put like APRV, okay, and I was just telling your chief resident, we are so into CAT scans. I come around at 10 p.m., 4 CAT scans are waiting for the patient to be done. So this is dangerous. Because you are using like here pressure high and pressure low, and use really high pressures. And between the pressures, you are allowing the patient to spontaneously breathe. And patient is taken for CAT scan without a portable vent. Okay, and even the portable vents do not have this mode. And you are like deflating the patient from a very high PEEP to a very low PEEP. And then they come back and you are unable to oxygenate and ventilate the patient again properly. So please use caution. The AMBU bags have PEEP valves. You are aware of it, right? Whenever you have a patient with severe ARDS in the ICU, when your respiratory therapy is supposed to know that, but again, they are also probably sometimes, laid back or withdrawn. Please caution them. When you take the AMBU bag with this patient, when you disconnect for suction, for hypoxemia, make sure you have a PEEP valve on the AMBU bag and increase the PEEP to 15. So you do not de-recruit the alveoli. By giving high PEEP, you are keeping the alveoli open and decreasing the dead space ventilation. So that's why use a PEEP valve. And number two, anybody with ARDS, you are taking the patient to a CAT scan, make sure you ask for a portable ventilator. Really, there are portable ventilators, they are underused. And everything, the same thing happens. Like recently I had a 30-year-old patient who had the typical classic pneumococcal pneumonia. And then he developed a complicated paraneumonic effusion, went into ARDS, septic shock and everything like that. He had such complicated loculated effusions, we needed to put tubes to, because he was persistently febrile. They wouldn't do it unless I do the CAT scan. So the guy went down for CAT scan, even though we took all precautions, he aspirated on the way back with sedation, with portable ventilator, with two residents taking the patient. And for 2-3 days, I had to leave him on 100% oxygen. It became very difficult for me to re-oxygenate and re-ventilate at low tidal, low FiO2. So that's what is done. Luckily, he is one of the few guys who also developed the critical illness polyneuropathy. Sepsis is very, very common that they develop because you over-sedate the patient and everything. He could not walk the time he left, but a month later, lucky for him and lucky for us, he came back walking to the clinic. So those are the things you really have to be very careful. De-recruitment of the alveoli. So please use portable ventilators. Please use PEEP valve when you are ambuing the patient. And if really that CAT scan is not going to change the management, there's no point in really like repeating CAT scan just for our comfort, just to make sure, use bedside ultrasound. That's why actually critical care ultrasound will be the thing that's going to help us probably more. And this is why actually so many people are unclear what the PEEP is. We should be considered the pressure high as PEEP or pressure low as PEEP or mean as PEEP. We really don't know the data. And sometimes I've seen people switch suddenly from APRV to CMV of 5. And they are alveoli. And it's very difficult to reoxygenate the patient. And high frequency ventilation, more studies are done in pediatric patients than adults. This also reduces the barotrauma and improves the BQ mismatch. You really give respiratory rates of about 20 and volumes about 60 ml. So it's really high frequency and low tidal ventilation. This actually prevents barotrauma because you're only giving 60 ml volumes, but you're ventilating the patient with a very high rate. Technically, it improves the VQ mismatch, But the potential complications is you do not leave the patient to clear the mucus or anything proper, even suctioning. So the mucus plugs can be formed, and that again can worsen your VQ mismatch. And airway damage can occur due to the high gas velocities and over distension because of repeated high frequency and worsening acute lung injury. So, it's a jet ventilator, yeah. But there are actually like manual jet ventilators that the anesthesia tries to use in difficult airway. If they cannot intubate a patient, you just do a cricothyroid thing and you connect it to the 100% oxygen, and probably you get 20-30 cc, like a 20 cc syringe, high oxygen. You prevent anoxic brain injury by the time you can get a real tracheostomy. So it's equivalent to that. But here they give a little tidal volumes. Okay, and there is prone positioning. Again, this prevents, recruits more alveoli. Again, the most studies, it's very difficult to prone the patient. The theory is like you prone the patient for 2 hours and the benefit lasts for about 12 to 24 hours. So you have to do this prone positioning almost daily. And most studies, they have complications of accidental extubation, patient dying from it. So difference in outcomes of mortality has not been shown. And people with so many IV lines and everything, so it's very difficult. And people have developed aspiration. And permissive hypercapnia, the potential complications I told, permissive hypercapnia is another concept. But that can cause pulmonary vasoconstriction, pulmonary hypertension, arrhythmia, cerebral vasodilatation, increased intracranial pressure. But as long as you maintain certain pH and a PCO2 is not more than 60 or 70, these complications are there. And I already mentioned to you, some people use prophylactic chest tubes. And inhaled nitric oxide, I heard like they use it in CT surgery at Monty, and maybe even in NICU once or twice a time. These are the people who post cardiac surgery develop acute lung injury, and they try to use it. But there are so many potential complications. Again, long-term benefit has not proven. The dose varies from anywhere from 1.25 to 40 parts per million. And you have to give it from days to weeks, and it's not environmentally safe for people who are into this new thing. To keep the environment safe, it's not environmentally safe. So it's very like, you have to be very careful with it. And potentially it can cause renal dysfunction, immunosuppression. In some long-term studies, there was some mutagenesis reported, and you can get hemoglobinemia from nitrogen dioxide concentration. Okay? Steroids are really very controversial in ARDS. The cytokines really like decline over the first week in survivors of ARDS, but persist in non-survivors. So that's why actually in people who survive the second week, giving steroids may help. Okay, so that's why people do go. Recently actually we had one patient, it's a very strange case because she's HIV negative, high LDH, but she turned out to be PCP positive. So during second week, although we debated, she came like a regular pneumonia 1 month later. I don't know what it is, but second week, we ended up giving steroids, quote unquote, for potential for the PCP. She got better in days. But is it like cryptogen? No, she's not even a cancer patient. But it is reported actually in non-HIV patients PCP. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a contaminant. I don't know if it's a wrong sample, but 2 samples were done. And still, it's more steroids today. But her clinical presentation really was more like cryptogenic organizing pneumonia or bronchiolitis obliterans occlusive pneumonia. And the other thing to remember is PCP in non-HIV patients, actually prognosis and outcomes are much worse. Okay, so it is reported, but she had not even cancer. And that happens in people in cancer patients, PCP, when they're tapering the steroids. And this lady hasn't been even on anything. For me, like the steroids, most likely, I don't know if it benefited the ARDS or it benefited, maybe we missed some cryptogenic organizing pneumonia because we never biopsied. So if Dr. Maiduri, you put up his name on Medline, like for the past 20, 30 years, he's trying to advocate steroids on this patient. But none of the studies, he's unable to prove any benefit in mortality or outcomes. And actually, he also wanted even to give for community-acquired pneumonia, giving steroids showed some mild improvement. Not just ARDS, just community-acquired pneumonia. So that's why, if at all it's given, this is the one. The thing to remember is not to be started before day 7 of ARLI or admission beyond 28 days. It really should be between week 1 and week 4. After that, there is no benefit. But this one, I think, again, remember that there are some exceptions, like now in sepsis, if people have it in insufficiency, you give early steroids. And those are the patients you also see with acute lung injury. So that's why you can give in people who are adrenal insufficient. Previously they said if patients come in septic shock, they don't respond to the low dose pressors, give steroids empirically. Now that theory is changed to give steroids, check a level, and only if they are adrenal insufficient, give it. And the other novel therapies are albuterol, salmeterol. Remember, in the study that they gave albuterol IV, not inhaled albuterol. And the theory about this is it decreases the lung water. And decreasing lung water has improved outcomes in these studies. So that's exactly why they gave. Salmeterol also the same thing. Surfactant. Pentoxifilin is more for binding the free oxygen radicals and decreasing the O2 toxicity. And the same thing with the other antioxidants. The only type of ARTS that antioxidants made any difference was in people with a history of alcohol abuse. We don't know why, because maybe your liver synthesizes more antioxidants and they have some underlying liver disease. Like mucomys, we give for the same reason, right? For people with Tylenol toxin overdose to protect the liver injury. Nobody knows the mechanism, but any benefit was only seen in people with alcohol and ARDS. And tumor necrosis factor antibodies, infusion, pure antiproteinases, these are all still experimental. And remember, the cause of death is really not refractory hypoxemia. It's the underlying cause or secondary complications from VAB, GI bleed or multi-organ failure. And that's why it's also like, I like to stress management of secondary effects from ARDS, not just the primary. Judicious use of sedation, neuromuscular blockade, hemodynamic management. That's why these days, after giving a fluid challenge, if blood pressure doesn't come up, start pressors. Don't keep on giving fluid challenge and make it more a wet lung. After a liter or two bolus, 20 ml per kg body weight in an hour. That's the guideline. If pressure doesn't come up, start pressors early and maintain the blood pressure. And also nutritional support also is being advocated more and more, not only to prevent hypoalbuminemia, but to prevent translocation of the gut organisms. These translocated gut organisms are more gram-negative and cause secondary gram-negative bacteremia and sepsis. That's another reason, early nutritional support. Glucose control, definitely in ARDS patient in the ICU. If anything made any difference in glucose control, intensive insulin therapy is sepsis and acute MI. Okay, the reason it's not being advocated for every ICU patient is because there are more hypoglycemic deaths. And they didn't show tight glycemic control made any difference in the outcome. But still for sepsis and acute MI, it does make a difference. And nosocomial pneumonia prevention and treatment and GI and DVT prophylaxis. And this is what actually you have to watch out when people are recovering from ARDS. Last year, this 36-year-old young man came to the ICU. He had underlying diabetes. I forgot if he came with pneumonia or sepsis. He got intubated. He recovered. When we thought he's recovering, he actually developed acinetobacter ventilator cell pneumonia. He didn't get out of the hospital. He died in the hospital. That's why we have to watch for. If anything we have to do is like those people with no underlying chronic illness, that's what you really have to aim to prevent. So that's why preventing ventilator associated pneumonia is very, very key. The definition is such broad spectrum. This is NIH. Does a surveillance on ventilator-associated pneumonia. Theoretically, they are preventable. That's why these days you have ways to prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia. Definitely, head end of bed elevation 30 degrees, mouth care, avoiding vent circuit changes or clearing of the ventilator condensate definitely has shown to prove improved outcomes in ventilator surgery. But not really. Continuous subglottic aspiration of secretion. There are special ET tubes actually that they have a special port. You connect to a suction and continuously do low suction and clear the supraglottic secretion. Because most of the time when pneumonias happen, they are really pseudomonas pneumonias and gut related gram-negative organisms. So it doesn't help really. And selective GI tract decontamination also didn't show any effect. Definitely it does not prevent the common back are really staff and Pseudomonas. And now obviously a Pseudomonas in our hospital. Everybody has ESBL and a Pseudomonas. ESBL, E. coli. Everybody you turn around, they have it. I don't know where this is coming from. Okay? And closed suction is really of no benefit. We are using it, but again, and avoid unnecessary antibiotics so you don't have to like come across resistance. And there is like, you know, people are trying to sell silver impregnated or antibiotic coated ET tubes to prevent. That showed no difference actually. Okay? So, any questions? The thing to remember is really like prevent secondary complications and support them. Volvic trauma, barotrauma, permissive hypercapnia. These are the terms to remember. And you know, you can get all these articles from the website, thoracic.org. ATS. Okay? Okay, check it. Thank you. As I said, I finished in 40 minutes. You want the slides also?
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you.